Hello everyone, this is Tom Fox and welcome to this episode of the FCPA Compliance and Ethics Report. Today it is my distinct pleasure to have my good friend and colleague Jim McGrath with me. Jim is a well-known expert on the subject of internal investigations. He's a lawyer in private practice, has a wide variety of both private practice experience, government service, and has been a prosecutor. So with that, Jim, thanks very much and welcome.
Thank you.
Jim, I'm really excited to have the chance to visit with you because what I wanted to visit with you on is something near and dear to both our hearts, which unfortunately today is the National Football League.
Right.
And there have been some pretty serious allegations made against the league, against some of the individuals involved for some felony conduct that could lead to criminal charges. But what I really wanted to talk to you and visit with you about is the league's response, the league's internal investigation, what you might see as some of the weaknesses of their investigation, and really what would be the lessons for the compliance practitioner for their own internal investigations process. So with that, let me set the stage first with Ray Rice, now formerly of the Baltimore Ravens. Mr. Rice had assaulted his then fiance, now wife, and a video was made of the assault and the immediate aftermath where he takes her out of an elevator. I think most of us had seen the video of him taking her out of the elevator, but we've not actually seen the assault take place. Before the second video was released, Rice was interviewed and the NFL did an investigation, and that led to a 2-game suspension of Ray Rice. After the video was released, both the Ravens, his team cut him, and then he was given an indefinite suspension. So really, with setting that stage, what are some of the things that you see maybe the NFL could or should have done different in the investigation area?
Well, I think first off, they were remiss in not seeking that larger tape. Now, that said, I'd like to say that we knew before the second tape came out that he had punched his girlfriend and that she was unconscious and he had dragged her, you know, back to their hotel room, and he had pled to an offense of domestic battery or whatever it's referred to in the state of New Jersey. So it was really gratuitous and somewhat extra to have the videotape. I mean, as someone said to me the other day, how do you think she got unconscious? She was hit, of course.
Right.
So the video really appealed to the prurient interest, I think, of the public, and that's why it made such a big splash. But that said, I think that the NFL was remiss in not seeking that tape, and they've created a Watergate-type situation for themselves, I think, whereby the cover-up or the justification for not doing what they should have done in the first place is now spiraled out of control so that it's a bigger story than not getting the tape. And by that I mean that, you know, at first they tried and couldn't get it, then it came out that law enforcement had said that they didn't ask appropriately, and then they said they didn't know if they could get it from an alternate source, and yet Ray Rice's attorney had it, and I believe he indicated he would have given it to them had they only asked him. And so plainly what that raises in my mind is the question that perhaps the NFL really didn't want to know all these facts, that with Ray Rice being a very large star, a very money-making name to the league and to his individual team, I don't think they wanted him off the field any longer than he had to be. And so sort of limiting their knowledge or manufacturing some plausible deniability or willful ignorance, you know, they could say that we're going to give him the 2-game suspension that they did and be done with him, get him back to the field sooner. I think if they would have gotten this tape, the more explicit second video earlier on, it would have been a little bit harder to do that. That said, and I don't mean to digress too much, but that said, I'm not sure that they could have given him more time. I mean, I'm not a collective bargaining agent expert, but it seemed to me that the rub that Roger Goodell, the commissioner, first cited, and that was that they did not have a specific disciplinary provision in the CBA for this type of situation, if correct, probably would have allowed him to stick with the 2-game suspension regardless of the subsequent tape coming out or not, and that he created the bigger problem for him, and the league has a bigger problem now because of the cross denials and disproven denials that have come out ever since then.
We certainly said a lot in there. I do want to get to the discipline that was meted out at the end of the process. But one of the things I've been intrigued about is you've written extensively on internal investigations, and one of the things that I think you try to convey is there needs to be a protocol, and there needs to be a protocol that's written really in the light of day, not in the middle of an emergency situation, so that everyone knows their roles and responsibilities. What would you suggest for a company that's looking into an internal investigation protocol? What are some of the things that you think are important to lay out?
Well, you know, I think that, first of all, you have to take a little bit of time, and I know that's hard to do when there's a pressing matter that's on the front burner, but haste makes waste, and I think that's exactly what happened here, and we can use it as a template for investigations in general, but it seems to me that you had no investigation plan really here in place, or at least not one that had any sophistication to it. I'm guessing that the league may have trusted, you know, its security people to go out and get a copy of the tape, and they fell down and didn't do that. But that's not the same as having a plan from the get-go as to how you're going to deal with that. And in that we're here at Compliance Week, I just walked out of a session on investigations where they were talking about, the speakers were talking about just that, and that is getting buy-in and input from various business units so that everyone understands where this is going and what their role is to play in it. And I think that's what, you know, the NFL needed to do. They needed to sit back. They needed to involve legal. They needed to involve their league security. They needed to involve you know, Stephen Biscotti as the owner of the Ravens and the entire Ravens team, and say, this is what our game plan is. This is what we know or believe to be out there in terms of evidentiary materials, that we're going to acquire it, and we're going to review it from there. And that way everyone's on the same page. And this is a classic example of nobody being on the same page.
One of the things that has come out is that the Associated Press, the AP, had a report that an anonymous law enforcement official provided the tape of the assault to a representative of the NFL, and that representative acknowledged receipt of the tape. If that is true, and if a lower-level functionary receives information in an organization, and doesn't raise that to an appropriate level for review, that would seem to me to be similar to the problem that Rutgers University got into when their basketball coach was filmed assaulting basketball players during practices. And for reasons that are still not clear, these were not presented to the chancellor or the president of the university. And when he did see them, it took him less than 5 minutes to terminate the coach's contract. How would you suggest a company ensure that information that needs to be reviewed make it up to the appropriate levels of review?
Yeah, you know, that's a very good question, and I think it's analogous to a question someone asked me once before, and that was, how do you treat whistleblowers? You know, and because I think that most whistleblowers are not whistleblowers for the money that's now offered under Dodd-Frank as a bounty for turning in bad conduct. I think they want to do the right thing, but, you know, they too want to know that something is going to be done. So that communication, I think, is important, and that's all part of setting the investigation plan that we just talked about. I think if, in the instance you talked about with the low-level employee, the secretary or whoever it was that supposedly got a tape from a named law enforcement officer, I'm certain that if a memo was put out to the appropriate personnel, and she, you would think, as a league office, you know, headquarters type person would be privy to this or part of it, you know, as to the fact that an investigation was ongoing, there was a protocol in place, and that, you know, anyone who had any input, evidence, whatever, that bears on that needs to give it to whomever was in charge of the investigation or some other appropriately identified contact person, you wouldn't have that issue. That secretary would have called whomever and said, a policeman just dropped off a tape that says or shows, you know, the interior of the elevator and the assault that took place there. And I don't think you would have that issue. So you know, I think it's the same thing. I think you have to have open lines of communication. And I mean, of course, you can't tell people every last detail of your investigation, but certainly I think it's wise for people potentially in the loop to know that there is one ongoing and what the protocol should be if for some reason they're contacted by an outside person, contacted by the media even. Evidence comes their way, they hear, you know, allegorically something about what the incident might be, you know, office chatter or water cooler gossip or something like that. I think if there's appropriate communication, then people know what to do with that kind of information.
Jim, you worked in law enforcement, and I think many compliance practitioners, certainly myself included, have only practiced law or worked on the civil side of things. If a company is going through some type of internal investigation and they feel like they need to make a request to law enforcement for evidence, assistance, or something else, I think many of us on the civil side really wouldn't even know where to begin. Maybe using the NFL Ray Rice case as an example, how would the league have even made an inquiry to law enforcement?
You know, that presents an interesting question because it is valid, one of the excuses that the league gave, and that is that they had talked to somebody in law enforcement and they said that if this tape was going to be presented to a grand jury, then it wouldn't be disclosable, or at least not until it had been through the grand jury, and after that there's some argument, I suppose, whether it would be disclosable as a public record or not. But in virtually every state in the union, once a case is completed, those things generally become public records. I know in Ohio, where I am, a tape like that would become a public record as soon as the case was over. And of course, once it was entered as an exhibit in court, I mean, then it's in the public sector anyway. But I think that if they had taken a little more time, had coordinated with law enforcement, and probably had coordinated with the union, and I don't know the parameters of how fast they have to have a hearing for Ray Rice before they mete out discipline. I mean, I'm sure there's some due process that's afforded him there. But I think if they would have said, let's not jump the gun, let's slow down on this, let's see if there's any. I mean, obviously somebody knew there was a tape out there or a second tape out there. And I think if they would have said, let's slow this process down, we want to get it right, I don't know how the union argues with wanting to get it right, I think that would be a better angle. And once that's done, I mean, I find that law enforcement generally is very willing to share, especially with an administrative body or private organization of the stature of the league, and a lot of the league's people and the individual team security people are ex-FBI, ex-DEA, ex-Homeland Security. You know, they're dealing with a top-notch organization there. I have no doubt they would have shared that with them at some point. And I don't think the league would have had to, like, fight to get it either.
Right. I'd like to turn now to the discipline that was meted out to Ray Rice, because I think that's one thing that got a lot of people and organizations up in arms. He was originally given a 2-game suspension, and as you, I think, correctly pointed out, what did anybody think happened in that elevator when he's dragging her out by her hair and she's laying on the ground?
Right.
She clearly was knocked unconscious in some manner. And after he was given a 2-game suspension, and then the tape came out, he was given an indefinite suspension. It turns out today he is appealing the indefinite suspension, claiming that he fully disclosed his conduct to the commissioner, and the commissioner meted out justice, or suspension rather, 2-game suspension, based upon his full cooperation. So that's clearly an issue for the union under their collective bargaining agreement. But how do you feel about the question? And one thing that's bothered me a little bit is the consistency of discipline meted out. Do you have any thoughts on whether how important in any compliance program or any disciplinary system to have consistent discipline meted out for same or similar types of events?
I think if you don't adhere to that and don't strive to have that, especially if you're in a publicly traded company that might have a union, you know, General Motors and the UAW, Ford and the UAW, something like that, I mean, you're setting yourself up for undercutting the whole disciplinary process then, if you don't have even treatment. You know, someone who perceives that they're going to get uneven has been treated unevenly or disparately compared to a fellow employee who's done something similar is going to grieve that to an arbitrator, and you know an arbitrator is highly likely to go their way and return them not only to their job but with back pay and perhaps any other sanctions that have been placed upon them removed from them. So I think consistency is the hallmark there, and it doesn't surprise me that Rice has appealed this. My first thought when the league gave him the lifetime or the indefinite suspension rather was double jeopardy. Now of course double jeopardy and the rest of the Bill of Rights only pertain to government action, and this isn't government action, but you know, collectively they can bargain for the similar due process and equal protection and other type of rights. And I thought, you know, if I was him, I would, if I was his counsel, I would say, I hit her. I confessed that I hit her. I took my sentence from the court. You knew what that was. You gave me 2 weeks. Now all of a sudden there's a hue and cry over this more graphic video and I have an indefinite suspension. You know, the CBA does not permit that, which I'm going to make enemies out of the Baltimore Ravens hierarchy here, but or maybe the NFL too, which is why I had said to someone the other day that I think the league dialed up the Baltimore Ravens and said, do us a favor and cut this guy.
Wow.
He's a nightmare for the league. He's a nightmare for your team. Not Ray Rice isn't a nightmare, but the situation that has been created. And, you know, contracts in the NFL are not guaranteed.
Right.
You can be cut for any reason, the color of your shoes not being right. And it would not surprise me at all if they did that to get just around this issue of, you know, you have this indefinite suspension. So now his impediment is, will anyone else pick him up?
Right.
You know.
That's certainly an interesting twist. The other thing I wanted to raise with you is there have been other instances that we know of. A player from the Carolina Panthers who was convicted of domestic assault. We have a player from San Francisco 49ers who was arrested for domestic assault. One of the things that is a technique that's sometimes utilized is to put employees who are under investigation on administrative leave with full pay during the pendency of the investigation. Any thoughts one way or the other if that's an appropriate technique to use?
I think it goes a long way towards guaranteeing the presumption of innocence, or at least adhering to that belief. So I don't see that suspending someone with pay pending an investigation is wrong or a bad idea. You know, with respect to the Carolina Panther player, you have him playing as well, though, you know, and that becomes somewhat problematic if or but for the fact that he's pled out on that and he's awaiting sentencing. So I'm not sure how they justify that. I think that could potentially be as big, if not a bigger headache, than the Ray Rice situation the longer this fellow keeps playing. He's a defensive end, if I'm not mistaken. And the longer he keeps playing, because I heard a radio report too of the factual basis of it, and it sounds to be far worse than the Rice situation.
It's very, very horrific.
Yeah, and so I don't know how he continues playing. Although, you know, I would say for him or any employee in a corporate setting, you know, or organizational setting, I suppose, you know, you are presumed innocent in this country until found guilty, and I suppose in theory you could keep working. However, your keeping working and not being on administrative leave runs the potential, I suppose, for spoliation of evidence or witness tampering or something like that. So you probably don't have any choice to protect the investigation, I would say, than to have that employee not in their job description there.
Jim, we're near the end of our time, and so I'd like to really end with asking you a couple of questions about reputational damage. Certainly not forgetting that the individuals who were assaulted had felonies committed against them, or at least alleged to have been committed against them, and they suffered perhaps grievous injuries. But the NFL really seems to be taking a very big reputational hit on this, and one of the concepts I've seen you write about is, or one of the reasons rather, to have a protocol in place is to really try to deal with the reputational issues. Do you find that a fair assessment at this point?
Absolutely. You know, I think when there is trouble in any organization, for lack of a better description, I think people want to see the public, the shareholders, the board, the audit committee, whomever wants to see the grown-ups take over. You know, they want, somebody wants a paternalistic, it'll be okay, we have a plan to deal with it, type response to the situation. And I think if you have that in place, then you know, any of those groups can put confidence in the fact that there is a game plan there. And it's calmly put together, it's rationally put together, it's staffed by appropriate people who are competent in what they do, and, you know, we'll get to the bottom of, they'll get to the bottom of whatever the issue is, and then cooler heads will prevail in the end. You know, it reminds me of something I said once in a speech I gave down, I think, at the University of Florida, and that was, you know, you should take the time to get it right, and somebody has to have a cool hand, and if you have that, it has a calming effect on the whole organization and instills confidence in what you're doing. And, you know, instead of when companies get in trouble, they run out and they hire PR firms, and this is just a personal, you know, bent of mine, and they start to spin immediately, and I never understood that. I always thought that the better approach that would be better accepted by everyone, from the media to the public to the shareholders and all that, would be, you know, to come out with a stern face and a somber look and have the general counsel or the, you know, the CEO or whoever say, we've hired the best people, we have the best plan in place, we're going to execute the game plan, and wherever that takes us, you'll know what the results are, and we're committed to doing the right thing. And, you know, that's what the NFL should have done in this instance, too.
Jim, we're at the end, but I wanted to ask, if someone wanted to find out a little bit more about you or contact you with any questions might have, is there an email address they could get in contact with you?
Absolutely. You can get me at james.mcgrath, M-C-G-R-A-T-H, at McGrath Grace, G-R-A-C-E, all one word, .com, or you could reach me by phone, 216-403-8098. Or if you read the internal investigations blog, you can email me through that.
You know, I didn't even mention your blogging, Jim, but could you tell the folks a little bit about the internal investigations blog?
Sure. The internal investigations blog is something I've been writing now for probably 2 years. I've done it on the with the encouragement of some close friends who I'm very grateful to for having me start it. It's a general investigations commentary. It might deal with sports today, it might deal with FCPA tomorrow, it might deal with insurance fraud the next time. It reflects the sort of generalist purpose of our firm, which does investigations, McGrath and Grace, and I try to make it entertaining and a little bit of wry humor in there sometime, even in some of the most serious matters, so that it's a good read and that people can walk away knowing a little bit more than they did, having a different perspective than they might ordinarily get from a general compliance practitioner, and maybe put a smile on their face too.
Jim, we're at the end of our time. I'd like to really thank you. This has been just a wonderful chance to visit with you and get some of your thoughts on internal investigations and the NFL. So thanks a lot.
Thank you, John.